Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Tuesday, January 30th. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Texas and oil industry leaders condemn LNG export pause. The announcement takes a unilateral hammer to the American economy, American jobs, and national security. Christy Craddock, Railroad Commission Chair. This article is written by Mella McEwen, Oil Editor. The Biden administration has decided to delay consideration of new natural gas export terminals, though officials say the delay won't affect the 7 terminals already in operation and several more expected to come online in the coming years. Still, state and energy industry officials have reacted negatively to the announcement. The effort to slow/top development of NG export facilities is exactly the right move if we want to strengthen Putin and increase his wealth and influence in the world, said Mike Estman, Chief Executive Officer of Tall City Exploration. It's the exact opposite of what we should do. It seems to me that the administration's Department of Energy is making a strategic error, motivated by a desire to do something in the name of climate change at the risk of reducing the security of the free world. East Daily Analytics reported customers have been lining up to sign on to new LNG projects, with Mexico Pacific signing ExxonMobil LNG Asia Pacific to a 1.2 million ton per year commitment for its third train at the planned Saguaro Energia LNG facility on Mexico's Pacific coast. Saguaro Energia proposes to take Permian Basin natural gas through ONEOC's Saguaro Connector. Analysts with East Daily told the Reporter Telegram by email last week's decision shouldn't impact Saguaro because it is in a different jurisdiction. Yet another blow to an industry that is essential not only to our state and nation as a whole, but for the rest of the world during times of global instability and political turmoil, Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Association President Ed Longenecker said. The Biden administration's decision to pause pending approvals of LNG exports is a direct attack on America's economy and energy security. These restrictions, alongside the constantly delayed permitting processes, will have far-reaching consequences, both on our strategic allies' national security and American jobs and economic opportunities. Our strong LNG industry is not only providing tremendous economic benefits, but much-needed energy for our allies as well. Without the Biden administration's interference, the U.S. LNG export capacity was set to double through 2027, with LNG terminals in Port Arthur, Rio Grande, Golden Pass, Sabine Pass, Freeport, Corpus Christi, Plaquemines, Cameron, and Calcasieu Pass, accounting for a majority of this growth. These projects will uplift and create thousands of jobs across Texas and Louisiana for decades to come. With global demand for LNG projected to grow in 2024, American producers and operators are standing by to meet this demand, but cannot do this without the support and sensible policy of our elected officials. Also weighing in on the matter was Railroad Commission Chair Christy Craddock. The Biden administration's announcement that they are halting all future LNG exports takes a unilateral hammer to the American economy, American jobs, and national security, Craddock said. President Biden is scaling up his assault on America's energy industry to the profit and benefit of countries who are not our allies. This is a major mistake. Texas is already dealing with an all-out invasion at the border because the Biden administration refuses to secure it. And now he wants to cripple our economy to appease the most extreme, radical left members of his base. We must see these actions for what they are: a deliberate dismantling of America's strength and national security, and a direct retaliation against Texas for holding the line at our southern border. Texas will continue to take every necessary step to defend our border and our economy. Energy Workforce and Technology Council President Tim Tarpley said it was important to remember the role U.S. producers had in avoiding disaster following Russia's 2022 invasion of Ukraine. American LNG plays a fundamental role in powering the global energy market, Tarpley said. This move by the administration to potentially halt permits for U.S. LNG export facilities will widely disrupt ongoing projects across the Gulf Coast, creating a global economic shockwave across energy markets. Halting American LNG threatens the reliability of energy production both here at home and abroad. Additional regulatory uncertainty is the last thing American energy needs right now. The Energy Workforce and Technology Council joined the American Petroleum Institute, API, Independent Petroleum Association of America, IPAA, American Exploration and Production Council, AXPC, Center for LNG, CLNG, and dozens of other industry groups in a letter to Secretary Granholm warning that any further restriction of U.S. LNG exports could exacerbate the energy crisis in Europe, threaten U.S. jobs, and force quickly developing nations to rely on coal for their growing energy needs. U.S. LNG blunted a potentially disastrous situation in 2022 following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and Secretary Blinken emphasized that increased cargoes of U.S. LNG were critical to undercutting Vladimir Putin's meddling in Europe. While our European allies have made significant strides in reducing their reliance on Russian natural gas, thanks to American energy producers, Europe faces a considerable supply gap over the long term that should be met by American energy, not hostile nations. Moving forward with a pause on U.S. LNG export approvals would only bolster Russian influence and undercut President Biden's own commitment to supply our allies with reliable energy, undermining American credibility and threatening American jobs. This article is entitled, "Been There?" Seven Brew opens in Midland as coffee shop boom continues in the area, by Morgan Taylor Thomas, staff writer. Just like that, a new coffee shop has popped up in Midland. Seven Brew, a drive-through coffee chain originating in Arkansas, is opening another Permian Basin location after a successful Odessa launch last May. The Midland location sits right off Loop 250 in between Raising Cane's and Hawaiian Brothers. Construction is also in the works for a second spot in Odessa. Other West Texas 7 Brew locations include the two in San Angelo, while the Panhandle carries three in Lubbock and one in Amarillo. The Reporter-Telegram spoke to Kevin Dawson, development insider and operator of Maybe in Midland, Odessa, about the nonstop addition of coffee shops in the area. "We are seeing an abundance of new coffee shops popping up in the area because coffee franchises are low-cost investment with high returns for investors. Plus, the growth markets that these chains are targeting are areas where Starbucks has a large presence. And when given an opportunity, these markets are choosing anything other than Starbucks," he explained. In 2023 alone, Midland gained 5 new coffee options: Swanky Hotspot Leyenda Coffee and Tequila, the Morning Edition from Sip House, the Wall Street Hub from further Low Street Books owner called Rorschach, First Basin location Scooters, and the expansion of Far West Coffee. The opening of 7 Brew, which Dawson said he expects to be in 3 to 4 weeks, already comes in at number 3 for 2024. The first two being the announcement of Yellowstone star Cole Hauser's partnership with HTO and the highly anticipated opening of Dutch Brothers. According to the 7 Brew website, the drive-thru only shop offers frozen and hot drinks, cold brew, energy drinks, teas and lemonades, smoothies and shakes, fizzes and sweet sips. This is a correction printed in today's Midland Reporter Telegram. In the January 27th issue of the Midland Reporter Telegram, a letter to the editor was incorrectly formatted and placed as a guest column. This article is entitled, "Former Marfa Substitute Teacher Pleads Guilty to Producing Child Sexual Abuse Material," by B.K. Richter, staff writer. Sonia Conchita Murillo, who was a substitute teacher for the Marfa Independent School District, pleaded guilty earlier this month to 1 count of production of child pornography. According to court documents, during an investigation involving Murillo's former boyfriend, 36-year-old Patricio Javier Serrano, for possessing child sexually abusive materials, videos also were found of Murillo sexually abusing a minor. Murillo, 32, pleaded guilty to 1 count of production of child pornography. A sentencing date has not been set at this time. Murillo faces a maximum penalty of 30 years in prison, along with a $250,000 fine. A federal district court judge will determine any sentence after considering the U.S. sentencing guidelines and other statutory factors. Murillo has been in federal custody since her arrest in June of 2023. Serrano, who was charged in a separate indictment, was arrested in May of 2023 and has remained in federal custody since his arrest. Serrano, a former Marfa youth softball coach, pleaded guilty on October 27, 2023, to 1 count of transportation of child pornography, aiding and abetting, and 1 count of possession of child pornography. He faces no less than 5 and up to 20 years in prison for the transportation charge, and up to 20 years in prison for the possession charge. Serrano's sentencing date is set for February 27, 2024. The FBI, HSI, Texas Department of Public Safety, and Marfa Police Department are investigating the case. Assistant U.S. Attorney Amy Greenbaum and Kevin Caton are prosecuting the case. This case was brought as part of Project Safe Childhood, a nationwide initiative to combat the growing epidemic of child sexual exploitation and abuse, launched in May 2006 by the Department of Justice. The initiative is led by U.S. Attorney's Offices and CEOS. Project Safe Childhood marshals federal, state, and local resources to better locate, apprehend, and prosecute individuals who exploit children via the Internet, as well as to identify and rescue victims. For more information about Project Safe Childhood, please visit www.justice.gov/PSC. This article is entitled, "Math Counts Competition Exposes Students to Teamwork, STEM Fields," by Ben Schaffer, staff writer. The Math Counts Competition allows local middle schoolers to collaborate with others and gain exposure in the STEM field. This year's local annual competition is hosted by the Permian Basin chapter of the Texas Society of Professional Engineers. It will take place at Midland College on February 17th, according to TSPE's Permian Basin chapter. Amanda Benson, director of the TSPE Permian Basin chapter, said the nationwide mathematics coaching and competition program is for 6th, 7th, and 8th graders and starts at the local level. Participating schools will compete in their chapter Math Counts competition. The top team and individual performers from the chapter will compete at the state competition in March. And winners from the Texas State competition will move on to the national Math Counts competition. Benson said Texans won the Math Counts competition in both team and individual categories. The TSPE Permian Basin chapter stated that the program is built around a handbook that is updated annually with more than 300 math problems. Competitions are comprised of 3 rounds of written testing, sprint, target, and team. The sprint portion focuses on speed and accuracy, according to the Math Counts website. Students have 40 minutes to complete 30 math problems without a calculator. The target round focuses on problem solving and mathematical reasoning. Students receive 4 pairs of problems and have 6 minutes to complete each pair, assuming the use of a calculator, the website states. In the team round, students have 20 minutes to complete 10 math problems with the use of a calculator. Only 4 students on a school's team can participate in the team round. Not only does it give them a chance to express their abilities to do math and collaborate as a team, but it's also a chance for them to be exposed to engineering. All the STEM, science, technology, engineering, math fields, because it's being put on by the local engineering society. We're able to kind of give an overview of what we do in our communities, and they can kind of see what going into an engineering field or a math-based field would look like, Benson said. The Texas Society of Professional Engineers is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting and enhancing the profession and licensed practice of engineering. https://www.tspepermian.org. This article is entitled MCSO, Man Arrested for Capital Murder, by B.K. Richter, staff writer. Late Friday, the Midland County Sheriff's Office Warrants Division and the Midland County Sheriff's Office SWAT team, assisted by other local, state, and federal agencies, located and arrested 26-year-old Davari Lamont Murray. Murray was wanted by the Midland Police Department for capital murder. He has been booked into Midland County Central Detention. This article is entitled Midland Animal Services Closed Thursday, by Ben Schaffer, staff writer. The City of Midland Animal Services will be closed on Thursday for mandatory staff training, the City of Midland said in a press release. The city said that the course will help staff members enhance their ability to provide care for animals and the community. The course will equip our staff with essential skills to manage the emotional and psychological challenges inherent in animal care and euthanasia, said Melissa Griffin Hobson, Animal Services Manager. Given the importance of this training, it is mandatory for all our staff members to participate, hence the need to close our services for the day. During this time, on-call emergency staff and dog reclaims will be available by calling 432-685-7420. Those with emergencies after regular business hours should call the non-emergency number at 432-685-7108, the city stated. This article is entitled Midland Sheriff's Office Arrests Man for Oil Theft, by B.K. Richter, staff writer. A man was arrested on charges of petroleum theft after deputies from the Midland County Sheriff's Office patrol responded to the area of FM 1213 and ECR 130 about a petroleum theft on January 22nd. During the investigation, deputies were advised that a tractor truck hauling a water tanker had entered an oil field lease and had possibly taken crude oil from a tank battery without the consent of the oil field company. Midland County deputies were able to locate the suspected tractor truck and conducted a traffic stop in the process. The driver of the tractor truck was identified as Jesus Fabian Rodriguez Scobel, age 32. The investigation found Scobel to have 34 barrels of stolen crude oil. Additionally, Scobel had two third-degree felony warrants out of Glasscock County for theft of petroleum products over $10,000 and under $100,000. Scobel was arrested and booked into the Midland County Central Detention Center on a new third-degree felony charge of theft of petroleum product over $10,000, under $100,000, along with the other two pending out-of-county warrants. The investigation is ongoing. This article is entitled Permian Basin Local Food Summit Set for Stanton by the Midland Reporter-Telegram. Ogallala Commons, a nonprofit education and leadership organization, www.ogallacommons.org, invites the interested public to attend its Permian Basin Local Food Summit 2.0 on February 15th at the Martin County Library, located at 200 North Mary Street in Stanton, from 9:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The event will provide information, ideas, and inspiration for food producers, crafters working in the Permian Basin region, as well as networking opportunities to attain a successful growing and marketing season. In the morning session, producers from Midland and Odessa will cover growing food in West Texas, followed by steps and tools for improving soil biology given by Chad Wall, owner of Natural Ecosystem Restoration in Wolfworth. At 11:30, Jessica Tuller-Karum, Executive Director of Growing Together Texas, will speak on building a larger marketing structure. Just before a catered lunch in the Methodist Church Fellowship Hall across the street, Ethan Carter will present a mushroom appetizer course featuring produce from his E3 farm. The afternoon session will begin with a panel presentation on diversifying local meat production and marketing, featuring panelists from Canyon Valley Provisions, Cotter Key Farm, and Odessa Charcuterie. Sarah Burnett from Texas Earth Inc. will address amending your soil for improved production. The summit will conclude with a presentation on envisioning a food hub in the Permian Basin by Blaze Diamond, OC Rebuilding Local Food Systems Program Coordinator from El Prado, New Mexico. The registration fee for the summit is $35 per person. Anyone interested can register online by using this link, https://bit.ly/3NRRH84, or send a $35 check to Ogallala Commons, 919 Main Street, Springfield, Colorado, 81073. Permian Basin Local Food Summit 2.0 is presented by Ogallala Commons with generous grant support from XTO Energy. For more information, please contact Daryl Birkenfeld, Deputy Director, Ogallala Commons, at 806-945-2255 or daryl@ogallacommons.org. This is the Life Tributes column. Lynette Hermine Foyle Irwin, July 10, 1935 to November 7, 2023. Our family lost our beloved mother and grandmother on November 7, 2023, Election Day. It was quite fitting to be that day because she was such a proud American and showed it in her character, style, and decor. Lynette Hermine Foyle was born on July 10, 1935, in Bogalusa, Louisiana, to Lee Ethel Bateman and Herman John Foyle. After college, at the request of mutual friends, Hermine took a leap of faith and went on a blind date with a handsome geologist named Eugene Jean Irwin. Hermine and Jean married on January 30, 1960, in her hometown of Bogalusa. Their only daughter, Lynn, was born later that year in November in New Orleans. After a brief stay in Fort Worth, the Irwin family moved to Midland, where they lived for 38 years. When Jean retired in 2002, the couple moved to Bakersfield, California, to be closer to their daughter, Lynn, her husband, Brad, and grandson, Cameron. In November 2007, Jean passed away suddenly. Hermine is preceded in death by her husband, Jean, her parents, Herman and Lee Ethel, and her sister, Hope. She is survived by her daughter, Lynn Califf, son-in-law, Brad, grandson, Cameron, step-grandson, Chris, and his wife, Val, and daughter, Millie, step-grandson, Kyle, and his wife, Brittany, and sons, Jackson and Calvin. Family was everything to Hermine, and there will be a graveside ceremony and burial for both Hermine and Jean in the spring of 2024 in Bogalusa, Louisiana, at the Foyle family plot. Please feel free to donate to a charity of your choice. Jesus Adolfo Urquieta Sr., January 19, 1953 to January 11, 2024. It is with heavy hearts that we share the news of the passing of Jesus Adolfo Urquieta, Sr., a beloved husband, father, grandfather, brother, and friend. Born on January 19, 1953, in El Paso, Texas, to Adolfo and Maria Luisa Urquieta. Among Adolfo's proudest accomplishments were his beloved wife of 50 years, Maria Urquieta, and their four children, Veronica Navarrete, Rick, Adolfo Urquieta Jr., Sean, Aaron Urquieta, Laura, and Paul Urquieta, Lyndon. Adolfo also adored his eight grandchildren. In addition to his immediate family, Adolfo leaves behind siblings Carmen Mendevil, Josefina Nava, Maria Torres, Manuel Urquieta, Angelica Urquieta, and Claudia Urquieta. A mass will be celebrated to commemorate Jesus Adolfo Urquieta on February 9th at St. Anne's Catholic Church in Midland. The service will be at 11 a.m. May he rest in eternal peace. Darrell Eugene McDonald, October 17, 1948 to January 25, 2024. Irving. On January 25, 2024, Darrell Eugene McDonald passed away peacefully in his home, embraced by the love of his family and friends. He was preceded in death by his parents, R.E. and Jeanette McDonald, and is survived by his wife of nearly 35 years, Kay McDonald, his children, Justin D. McDonald and his wife, Noemi, Allison A. Foley and her husband, Shane, and Shelton J. McDonald. His sister Harriet McDonald Walraven and her husband Dan, his nephew C. Chad Arnold and his wife Jennifer, as well as numerous grandchildren and many other nieces, nephews, and cousins. Darrell was born in Seminole on October 17, 1948. He attended New Mexico Military Institute and graduated from Greenville High School in 1966. In 1983, Darrell moved to Midland, became actively involved in the real estate business, acquiring a Century 21 franchise, and later forming Darrell McDonald Realtors. Darrell was a blessing to those who knew him, and we are deeply grateful for the gift of him. He will be dearly missed. Please visit www.sparkman-hillcrest.com for complete information. Jerry Lynn Sims, April 25, 1948 to January 26, 2024. Jerry Lynn Sims of Midland passed away in Lubbock on Friday, January 26th, after a valiant battle with multiple illnesses. Jerry was born in Kermit on April 25, 1948. In 1998, Jerry married Jan Spencer. They were the loves of each other's hearts and enjoyed 27 beautiful years together. Blending families, the arrival of grandchildren, hosting friends, they created a full and happy life together. Jerry is survived by his loving wife Janet Marie Spencer Sims of Midland, former wife Judy Taylor of Hobbs, New Mexico, and their children, daughter Kim Sims Chacon, Tony of Keller, Texas, son Steve Sims, Denise of Hobbs, New Mexico, Brian Trout, mother Jan of Midland, brothers Doug Sims of Kermit, and Larry Sims of Metropolis, Illinois, as well as seven grandchildren. Jerry was preceded in death by his parents, Earlene and Earl Sims. As per Jerry's request, there will be no formal services. If you wish to honor Jerry in this manner, Real Thanks in Midland, the Spina Bifida Association of North Texas, or the Scottish Rite Hospital for Children of Dallas all hold a special meaning for the family. Elizardo Madrid, August 12, 1949 to January 21, 2024. Elizardo Madrid ended his earthly journey January 21, 2024. He was born in Artesia, New Mexico, August 12, 1949. He is predeceased by his parents, Juan D. and Refugio Araujo Madrid. Elizardo, Ellie, graduated from Midland High School and continued his education at Solros in Alpine. At the time of his passing, he was teaching at Permian High School in Odessa. Although his passing was sudden and unexpected, he was surrounded by his loving family. Left to cherish Ellie's memory are his wife, Adrienne, his two sons, Leon and Victor, and his granddaughter, Isabel. Services are private. Mario Q. Fernandez. Mario Q. Fernandez, 68, passed away on January 26th. Viewing will be January 30th from 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. with a prayer service at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel. Funeral service is set for January 31st at 10 a.m., also at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home Chapel. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Timothy Ray Lucio. Timothy Ray Lucio, 38, passed away January 24th in Stanton. A visitation was held on Monday, January 29th, from 9 a.m. till 8 p.m. with a rosary at 7 p.m. at Stanton Memorial Funeral Home Chapel. Funeral Mass will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday, January 30th at St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Interment will follow at St. Joseph Catholic Cemetery. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Stanton Memorial Funeral Home and Chapel. Irma Villa Quiros. Irma Villa Quiros, 53, of Midland, passed away on January 25th. A viewing was held Sunday with a rosary at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. A funeral mass was held on Monday, also at Our Lady of Guadalupe Parish and Shrine. Burial followed at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Monica Noel Contreras. Monica Noel Contreras, 34, of Midland, passed away on January 25th. A viewing will be Wednesday, January 31st from 2 to 9 p.m., with a prayer service to begin at 7 p.m. at Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Chapel. Funeral service is set for Thursday, February 1st at 1 p.m. at First Christian Church. Burial will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens. Funeral service was entrusted to Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home, and family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Maria Isabel Herendia. Maria Isabel Herendia, 56, of Midland, passed away on Wednesday, January 24th. No services will be held. Funeral arrangements have been entrusted to Llewellyn Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home, and family messages and condolences may be emailed to pipkin@nts-online.net, or you can visit our website at www.llewellyngarciapipkinfh.com. Helen Zant Adcock, April 20th, 1937, to January 24th, 2024. Helen Zant Adcock died peacefully on Wednesday, January 24th, surrounded by family and loved ones. She was 86 years old. Helen was born in Midland on April 20th, 1937, to John Bradford Zant and Annie Lee Brunson Zant. Helen graduated from Midland High School in 1956 and then attended the University of Texas in Austin. It was there she met Clint Hurt. They were married and had two children, John Clint and Patrick Hurt. Helen and Clint eventually parted ways. Helen married John Robert Adcock in 1977. They were married until Johnny's death in March of 2016. Helen is predeceased by her husband John Robert Adcock and Johnny's son Patrick Rocks. She is survived by her two sons, John Clint Hurt and his wife June Fausch of Midland, son Patrick Hurt and his wife Tia Lustig of New York City, a brother John Zant and his wife Diette, granddaughter Margaret Hover, grandson Alex Hurt, two stepdaughters Darla Nelson and husband Joe of San Antonio, and Dina Buttenhoff and husband Alan of Tunnel Hill, Georgia, stepson Tony Rocks of Farmers Branch, and numerous great-grandchildren. Per Helen's wishes, there will be no memorial service. Tim Sean Carter, February 13, 1961 to January 25, 2024. Tim Sean Carter, 62, of Midland, entered the presence of his Lord and Savior Jesus Christ on Thursday, January 25th, surrounded by his family. After a valiant year-long battle with illness, we know he was met with a "Well done, good and faithful servant." A celebration of life will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, January 31st, at First Baptist Church in Midland. Tim was born on February 13, 1961, in Midland, to James and Eloise Carter. A lifelong resident of Midland, he graduated from Midland Lee High School in 1979. The following year, he started his college education at Texas Tech University, where he met Laura Frost, the love of his life. After graduation, they moved back to Midland, where they married in 1985. Tim joined his dad in the family furniture business and eventually became the sole owner of Carter's Furniture. Tim was a faithful husband to Laura for 40 years and the world's greatest dad to Emily and AJ. His latest and favorite role was being Pop-Pop to his beloved granddaughter Carter, the love of his life. Tim is survived by his loving and devoted wife Laura, his adoring daughter Emily Carter Bloodworth, her husband Hilton, and their daughter Carter, his son Austin James, AJ, his sister Diane Moore, his brother Steve Carter, his in-laws Sharon Frost Willard, Greg and Carrie Frost, and Wade and Michelle Frost, as well as numerous beloved nieces and nephews. Tim is preceded in death by his parents, James and Eloise Carter, mother and father-in-law James and Lavelle Frost, and brother-in-law Al Willard. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to the American Cancer Society, First Baptist Church of Midland, or Turning Point Ministries at davidjeremiah.org. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Pickle and Wells Funeral Home, and online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com.
Good morning, this is Kim, and I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Tuesday, January 30th. PHS Thespians heading for national contest. For the second time since 1999, Permian High School theater students will be competing in the International Thespian Festival in Indiana University in Bloomington in late June 2024. 8 students and head theater director Michaela Grenier's class achieved this goal. I am very proud of our competitors, including those who didn't qualify to move on at this time. These students had to prepare their competition pieces on top of their busy schedules for school, home, other productions PHS Theater did this semester, and any other activities they're involved in, Grenier said. This is just the second year since 1999 that our students attended and competed at the Texas Thespians Festival. Last year, we just had 5 students compete and 2 national qualifiers. This year, we had 13 entries and 8 qualifiers, Grenier said. The next step is to work on fundraising to make sure the students have a chance to compete at nationals, she added. The group includes juniors Brooklyn King and Madeline Linville, seniors Hope Joyce, Jay Dean, and Megan Lowry, and sophomores Wade Harvey, Colton Lewis, and Jonah Davison. In addition to Grenier, Raimundo Montoya is the technical theater director, and the students said they played an important role in their success. The state competition was in Grapevine in November 2023. Larry said she heard a rumor that the list of people going to nationals were going to be sent out on a particular night, so she stayed up all night waiting for it. I had used my friend's phone because mine wouldn't open the link. I ended up being number 958 on the list. I had to make her screenshot it and send it to me so I could send it to my family. My friends had to cover my mouth because I started screaming, Lowry said. Dean said he also found out he'd made it to nationals late at night and he was surprised. I'm pretty new to theater. I've only been doing it like 2 years, and whenever I was competing, there was some real serious talent when I wasn't doubting that, but the caliber of actors there was immense, so I kind of was iffy on the idea of getting to nationals, so whenever I actually did find out, it was a sense of achievement that I've never really had before, he added. Davison said he also was caught unawares when he was notified. I was on my phone just playing a game, and then my friend Caleb leans over and he's like, "Hey, oh, you made it," Davison said. He didn't know what his friend was talking about, so Davison looked up the list and saw he'd made it to nationals. Linville didn't think she had made it because the original list didn't include her, but then she got a call from Grenier, who told Linville there was an error in the tabulations and she had made it. It was very confusing because I had just gone through all the emotions of not making it, but I was very proud of myself because I had to choreograph my whole piece by myself, which was kind of hard. It just was a sense of pride, I guess, Linville added. Joyce said preparation of nationals means finding whatever you did to get to this point, whether it was a song, monologue, or stage managing, and really perfecting it so they put their best foot forward at nationals. Harvey, Lewis, and Davison performed a comedy at State. Lewis said he feels like finding something within themselves to bring out the inner character helped them make it to nationals. I also feel like I could have something to do with the genre because whenever we were there, every single play was really sad and ours was the only funny one, so everybody liked it. I feel like that might have had some part in it, Lewis added. Harvey said he's pretty sure What the judges were looking for was the potential they had as actors, not how much you aced it, but how much you could potentially ace it. There's a lot of individual work that will go into preparing for nationals, but they will have after-school tutorials, voice lessons, and time set aside to work with the directors. It's really a lot of by-yourself work, Joyce said. OC Board to Meet. Reports on programs throughout Odessa College are on the agenda for the Board of Trustees meeting set for 6:30 p.m. January 30th in the Zant Room of the Salisbury Campus Center, 201 West University Boulevard. The Culinary Program Vision 2030+ and the Workforce Summit are among the items for presentation. Part of Vision 2030+ is James C. Crest Stadium, the grand opening and ribbon cutting for the $6.5 million venue is planned for 11:30 a.m. February 2nd. Projects also include the Wood Health Sciences Building, the Amphitheater, Shade Structure, and Rudy Acosta Pavilion. Also on the agenda are the President's Report, which includes the Workforce Summit, Wrangler Outfitters and Wrangler Service Week kickoff, financial statements and budget amendments, quarterly investment report, pinning ceremony for police officer Mario Zubiotti, approved new foundation board members. OC Board to Meet. Reports on programs throughout Odessa College are on the agenda for the Board of Trustees meeting set for 6:30 p.m. January 30th in the Zant Room of the Salisbury Campus Center, 201 West University Boulevard. The Culinary Program Vision 2030+ and the Workforce Summit are among the items for presentation. Part of Vision 2030+ is James C. Crest Stadium, the grand opening and ribbon cutting for the $6.5 million venue is planned for 11:30 a.m. February 2nd. Projects also include the Wood Health Sciences Building, the Amphitheater, Shade Structure, and Rudy Acosta Pavilion. Also on the agenda are the President's Report, which includes the Workforce Summit, Wrangler Outfitters and Wrangler Service Week kickoff, financial statements and budget amendments, quarterly investment report, pinning ceremony for police officer Mario Zubiotti, approved new foundation board members. Texas GOP increasingly considers push to close its primaries. Texas Republicans are increasingly debating who should be allowed to vote in their primary as the March 5th contest nears with the presidential nominee at the top of the ticket. The debate has increased in recent days as presidential candidate Nikki Haley has talked openly about targeting states like Texas that have open primaries or primaries that are open to voters regardless of partisan affiliation. But even before the former South Carolina governor started trumpeting her strategy, GOP activists in Texas were zeroing in on limiting the state's primary to Republicans, crafting a non-binding ballot proposition on the March 5th ballot to gauge support for the idea. Haley's strategy only added fuel to the fire. This is a very obvious call for Democrat crossover voting in the Republican primary, which we know already happens in Texas on a large scale, Texas GOP Chair Matt Rinaldi said last week in response to a Haley campaign memo on the topic. The Texas GOP must prioritize closed primaries. Even U.S. Senator John Cornyn, who is often at odds with the state party under Rinaldi, said he is fine with closing the primary. I don't have any problem with closing the primary, but I don't see it as a huge issue in Texas, Cornyn said in a radio interview last week. Texas is one of 16 states that have open primaries, according to the National Conference on State Legislatures. Texas voters do not have to declare a party affiliation when they register to vote, and they can choose to vote in either the Democratic or Republican primaries. In the event of a runoff election, they cannot switch to the other party's primary runoff to vote. 8 states have fully closed primaries, according to the NCSL. Those are states where a voter formally affiliates with a party and can only vote in that party's primary. There are shades of gray, however, in several states. Voters can identify as unaffiliated with any party before a primary and then can choose which party to vote in. That is the case in New Hampshire, where Haley recently finished second to former President Donald Trump in its primary. Trump and his allies were quick to note that Haley appeared to benefit from New Hampshire's primary. Exit polls showed that independents or something else made up 44% of the electorate, and they favored Haley by a comfortable margin. Democrats comprised 6% of the votes, and they almost all preferred Haley. On a memo the day after New Hampshire, Haley campaign manager Betsy Anthony said they were looking forward to competing in upcoming open primaries, including Texas, calling them significant fertile ground for Nikki. 11 of the 16 Super Tuesday states have open or semi-open primaries, Anthony said, wrote. Of the 874 delegates available on Super Tuesday, roughly two-thirds are in states with open or semi-open primaries. Those include Virginia, Texas, Maine, Massachusetts, Minnesota, North Carolina, and Vermont, all with favorable demographics. Ironically, on the same ballot, where Haley hopes to attract non-GOP voters, the state GOP will have a non-binding ballot proposition measuring support for closing primaries in Texas. The proposition, 1 of 13, asks primary voters to vote yes or no on whether the Republican Party of Texas should restrict voting in the Republican primary to only registered Republicans. Closing the primary in Texas could require the state or parties to come up with a party registration system. Proponents have largely avoided the topic for now, instead focusing on raising alarm that Democrats are meddling in Texas GOP primaries. Beyond the presidential nominee, Texans will be asked to vote for their party's nominee for U.S. Senate, Congress, and Texas legislature. The state has long been dominated by one party, the GOP, and after redistricting, the general election is less competitive than it has been in years, placing even more importance on the primary. So it's not new that Democrats may feel like their vote matters more in a Republican primary than a Democratic one. But measuring the impact of crossover voting is seldom easy and accessible, requiring granular analysis of voters and their preferences. Even as he expresses openness to a closed Texas primary, Cornyn suggested it would not affect how he runs his races. I've run in a number of primaries, and you know, typically repeat voters, primary voters are the target for advertising, and those are the ones you are talking to, Cornyn said in the radio interview with Mark Davis in Dallas. And once the primaries are over, then you broaden your appeal to the people who are not primary voters, who are general election voters who you need to win. On the right, there has been a more specific outcry for crossover voting in special elections in Texas, which are now open and often so low turnout that such voting can make more of a difference. The dynamic was closely watched in 2021 when U.S. Representative Jake Elsey of Waxahachie upset a Trump-endorsed rival Susan Wright in a special election runoff for open congressional seat in North Texas. One GOP analysis later found that 14% of voters in the runoff were likely Democrats. It could be a factor in a special election runoff Tuesday for a Texas House seat in North Texas, where Jill Dutton is searching for a coalition that could defeat fellow Republican Brent Money and his army of big-name GOP endorsers. "I personally don't like special elections," conservative consultant Luke Macias, who supports Money, said in a recent podcast. "Politically, I hate them. The reason I hate them is because Democrats vote in special elections. It's not a Republican primary, so you can actually win the Republican Party primary voters in a Republican district 55-45 or 60-40 and still lose if enough Democrats show up and all vote for the more liberal option."
This is the Dear Abby column. Son's choices as grown-up draw fire from his father. Dear Abby, I am the father of an adult son, Kirk, who is in a relationship with a younger woman who has a young child. Neither is well-educated, but they both have decent jobs. Kirk has a teenage daughter who is getting ready for college in another state. They are close, although I'm not sure to what degree he supports her financially. I have saved some money for her college, but he has not. Kirk never married her mom. My concern had been that my son and his girlfriend might be trying to have a baby. When he told me she is pregnant, I was beyond livid and let him know what a mistake this was. I told Kirk he owns nothing, nor does she, and asked what that baby has to look forward to. His girlfriend receives no support from her child's father. My son has now stopped talking to me. Is this my fault? I spoke what I believed was in the best interest of all parties involved, financially and morally. Signed, Sees a Mistake in Florida. Dear Sees, sometimes before we speak, it is wise to ask ourselves, is it true? Is it helpful? Is it kind? While your comment was true, the girlfriend is already pregnant. Financially, Kirk will be on the hook until his second child becomes an adult, whether or not he marries the mother. So I'm thinking what you said was neither helpful nor kind. If you want a relationship with your son, it may be time to apologize. Dear Abby, I am a lesbian who has been in a relationship for a year and a half. My partner was with men the majority of her life. One of her last exes is someone she now calls her best friend. She talks with him and texts him every day. I now have trust issues with them because of something I saw 4 months ago. I love a lot about her, except she's not very affectionate with me, and I need that. I knew when I was first getting involved with her that he was going to be in her life. They have no children tying them together, but we all go kayaking often. Although I'm not comfortable with it, she has given me no choice if I want to kayak with her. She also hides things from me, like when she buys him gifts. How do I handle the jealousy I feel for him? I can't stand to be around him because I know in my gut there is deception. But I don't want to lose all the good I have with her. Signed, Three's a Crowd in Virginia. Dear Three's a Crowd, what does all the good stuff you have with her entail? What I gather from your letter is that you have spent a year and a half with someone who is bisexual, whom you don't completely trust, and who makes you feel like a third wheel. From where I sit, your jealousy is justified. Three in a relationship is awfully crowded, unless it's by mutual agreement. If you haven't talked to her about your feelings, you should. And if you can't arrive at a resolution, end your suffering and move on. You can contact Dear Abby at www.dearabby.com or P.O. Box 69440, Los Angeles, California, 90069.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.